Okay, and our official class clocks is 8 o'clock, so we're good to go for a little more time. I had one more example I wanted to show you, and again, the point to be made here is that sometimes reading an automaton is easier to understand what the token structure is than looking at the corresponding definition. So what I'm going to do here, I know I still have more blank paper, is generalize the notion of an identifier. In some languages, identifiers are allowed to have underscores so that you can have an identifier that appears to be multi-phrased. So the example here is unit cost. So you might want to have unit cost. And the underscore serves to tie together the two phrases and still make it a single identifier. If I try to use a blank, I'd have to worry about misscanning this as unit as one identifier, cost as a second, and then maybe joining them together. So you see a similar problem. Many file systems now allow blanks inside the name of a file, if it is something like unit cost as a file name. But actually, when you go down and look at the implementation, they have something like a backslash, a blank, to actually tie it together, the equivalent of an underscore in the actual implementation, so that it's unambiguous at the program level what is meant. These underscores are cool, but they can be misused. For example, if I allow an underscore at the end of an identifier, or for that matter at the beginning, it may easily be misinterpreted as a minus sign. It's also the case that if I have multiple underscores together, it's unclear how many I have. Do I have two or three or four? So I might want a definition that says, yes, you may use underscores, but in a rather restricted way. Namely, you can have it in the middle of an identifier, not at the beginning, not at the end. And if you have one underscore, you may not have a second consecutive underscore. There really isn't a lot of use for it. So you can have unit cost just as you would want as an extension. So that's my goal. But how do I go ahead and scan this to make sure that I have this rule? I cannot begin with an underscore, cannot end with an underscore, cannot have more than one underscore in the middle. But I can have multiple ones. I could have unit cost per pound, for example. That would still be allowed. So I can have two underscores as long as they're not adjacent and they are internal. Well, that sounds pretty terrible. But if you actually go on and look at the definition, there we go. It's not all that bad. It only has three states. That's pretty minimal. And it says, okay, obviously starting out there, I got to begin with a letter. So no trouble with an underscore beginning an identifier. I have the normal sort of identifier that doesn't use underscores at all. That's up here. It says if you have a letter or digit, just keep looping. Those are fine. It says, oh, yes, you may have an underscore. I'll take you off to this far right state. And you're kind of on a probation. It's accepted, but you still have to do a little good things to get off the hook. So in this case, you may not read another underscore because there's no path to it, but what you may read is a letter or a digit, and in that case, you're fine. You're back to having something on the left and something on the right of the underscore, and it's good to go. So it's not too difficult, I would say, to see that this accepts good usages of underscores, but not bad ones. Assuming I want this, if you look up here, this is an equivalent regular expression definition, and I'll explain it to you. But notice this is nastier, if only because I have two levels of iteration, an inner one and an outer one. This is also an example of why matching the bottom pattern is real easy. Matching the upper pattern, if you had to program it. Suppose I throw this definition at you and say, hey, here's the definition of a token I want, and you've got to write code to match just that, nothing more, nothing less. The bottom one is easy. You just do what I showed you earlier, namely you have tables and transition appropriately. So let's write this down and see why it is as it is. So the early part is not too bad. Obviously, it still begins with a letter. No problemo there. And it can have letters or digits following it, and zero more of those. This suffix is optional. It's got a star up there, so that can be the end of it. That's not too hard to read. But what confuses people, and understandably so, is why I have to have both the plus and the star there. The reason is there's two kinds of repetition I'm allowing. The first one says, yes, you may have an underscore, but then you must have one or more letters or digits. So letter or digit, and the plus there says you've got to have at least one so that I do not end the identifier with an underscore. And this star up here says this suffix may be repeated so I can have more than one underscore, suffix. So this allows me to say unit, and then I can say cost per pound. And each time I want to have additional underscore, I go back and do this. So this says I may have one or more phrases, if you would, that have an underscore and an identifier. So yes, this works, but my thinking is the regular expression form is less readable and understandable to human, and the bottom one is more understandable. But the one up top is something that's easy for a person to write down. This diagram with circles and arrows is less accessible to put into a computer. So what we'll do is, as I'll show you momentarily, is write it in regular expression form, feed it into a generator, which will internally build these little diagrams that represent finite automata, and then encode it in a table form, which is readily programmable. And that's actually the final step of our compiler generation. So let's talk a little bit about that. This is, we're going to use JLEX, but there are other variations that existed earlier, LEX and FLEX, and for every programming language around that's popular, you have a LEX version of that. It's the case, you know, that just anything. JLEX certainly exists, but there's a Python version. Does anybody know what it is? Is the Python fan here? There's a Python version of LEX, PyLEX or something. And it just shows how useful it is that everybody who has their favorite language tries to integrate a scanner generator, or if you would, a character pattern matcher into that language, just to make it that much more useful. Now, the key thing about this, again, that is good for you, particularly as implementers, is it's non-procedural, and also it's incremental. And that, I think, is the biggest win. What incremental means is you don't have to write an entire scanner all at once. What is recommended is you can write, you can write the simple tokens first and build a complete scanner that only handles those tokens. Now, most cases, if you have a working program and I say add to it, you got to step back and say, okay, what does the current guy do to make sure that I don't mess it up? But that's not true here to an almost universal extent. I can simply add in a new line of the definition to coexist with the others. And with a couple of minor gotchas, it doesn't matter. So you can add new tokens to an existing definition and not screw up the existing definitions. The new definition may be wrong, but it's not going to mess up the existing definitions except to the extent that it may steal patterns that were previously matched by somebody else. So that is really very important because that means as you're doing your scanner, do the easy ones and then add one more, test it, add one more and test it. And you have this real nice iteration where you do a little bit of programming and get it right, a little bit more and get it right until it's all done. Not all programming efforts are like that. And ones that are, because they're incremental, are very easy. It's also the case that I mentioned, and I'll re-mention it now, is that from project two on, you may have partners. One partner, two-person teams. That's totally up to you. Some people like to work alone. Others like to have a partner to chat with. And in this case, because the case that the definitions usually don't interfere with each other, I could easily imagine one person in the partnership taking this set of tokens and the other person taking the other tokens and then debug them independently and put them together near the end, verify that they in fact do coexist properly, and away you go. So it's a nice team-oriented project. And if you want to have a partner, fine. If you prefer working on your own, this is certainly doable by one person. It's not like you have to have two people just to keep it going. But I think in general, it's good when you're programming to have a partner to chat with, to say, here's what I understand. What's wrong? Is this a good idea, bad idea? You can talk to me or the TA, if the TA ever gets out here, but at least to me, and have the same effect. But a partner, you can, you know, just be much more open in terms of what your thoughts are. So what we're using is JLEX. JLEX is written in Java. We have it coded up, and I may have time today, if not today, next week, for an example of actually running JLEX through Eclipse. So I have a build file, a make file, no, build file for JLEX and calls. But basically, it's a Java program, and what it would do is, if you were running, remember Java, at the Java level, is JLEX.main is the main program for Java, for JLEX. And our convention is that you'll create a file name and suffix it with JLEX to say, this is the token definition in JLEX for a particular application. So in this case, if you're doing CSX, you might call the CSX.JLEX. If you're doing ClassPass and it turns out that Eclipse takes care of this, you have to update your class path. Oh, include without an E. Boy, I didn't spell check that. Sorry. I must have added that late. So what will happen is if this works properly, it'll take f.jlex and create you a Java scanner that's called f.jlex.java. That indicates it's a valid Java program, which can then be compiled by a Java system and run as an ordinary Java class. And I'll show you a bit more about that. So your job is to produce csx.jlex, and JLEX will then create the Java implementation of it. And that's a big help, because that means you'll never have to worry about doing things like, let's read a character, let's buffer a character, do I use this character or not, what token does this belong to, etc. All that will be handled automatically as part of the JLEX rules. So what's going to happen is it's going to create a very odd named class. It's going to be called YYLEX. And the question is why? No, the question is double why, I guess. This goes back to the early days of Unix when things were run in C. And anybody who's run old C programs, turns out that the way you do separate compilation in C is create separate modules, compile them with external references. And you, in turn, export external references. And God help you if two different implementations import or expect the same name. So what happened here is that says, this guy is going to export certain names to be used by other programs. But I don't know what other programs are going to use by their names, so I'm going to choose a prefix, which no sane person would be likely to use, and that's a double Y. So anything having to do with a Lex-generated scanner starts with a double Y. In Java, it's not as necessary, but it's sort of homage to the old days, where if you saw something named YY this or YY that, it had to do with Lex. So they're carrying it forward. I'm not sure if that was a great idea, but certainly it's not so terrible. We can't live with it. So what's going to happen is we're going to create, as part of YY class, the actual generated scanner, a method called YYLEX, which will actually do the scanning. And we can call that repeatedly to get one token at a time. So all of a sudden, scanning is a lot easier. Say, call them, says, read as many characters as you need to, and give me the next token. If I'm at the end of the file, it'll return me the end of the file token, saying, that's the end of it. But otherwise, it might be a single character, might be a whole line if I had a long quoted string, for example. Doesn't matter. It'll figure out how many characters. So what it'll do, I have a way of creating a new class, so class object, it's called YYLEX, that takes the name of the file, so I can embed in it the name of the file that's going to be read. It could be system in, but in our tests, it'll be some command line saying, please scan the contents of this file. And it'll open up a scanner with respect to that file and tell it to start eating little characters in that file to build tokens. And it'll give you a utility routine, which is very handy, that says, hey, you just did some scanning and matched some characters. Tell me what they were. So if I want, I can call yytext. That is the text of the token just scanned. And it'll give me a string saying, oh, yeah, I scanned it, and here are the actual characters I matched. That's useful, for example, if I just scanned an identifier. I want to remember that identifier's name. As you know, right now in Project 1, that thing is eventually going to go into a symbol table, and I have to have the string that names that identifier to be used in the symbol table. If I'm going to, for example, create an integer, I have to convert that from character form to an actual integer form. That can be a little tricky, and I'll talk about that. I'm not sure if in today's lecture, another one, how to do that fairly reliably. Because remember, you can have really big numbers, and how do I make sure I don't do overflow? One starting point is to take the character representation of the number and feed it into some Java utility that will convert from characters to numbers in a safe and reliable fashion. And we'll talk about how to do that. So let's see what it is you're actually have to program, and I'll show you an example about that. And by the way, the startup package for Project 2 is available on the internet webpage. So not only did I give you the paper definition, but there's a zip file for the Eclipse Archive project that's available. You can download that and start looking at things. But basically, what's going to happen is the input is going to be just a file that contains three segments. In many cases, those segments will be minor. In other cases, they'll be not so minor. They're separated by double percent sign as just a delimiter. And again, that goes all the way back to the original Lex. So the first will be user code. You don't have to have any, but you may. And this will be code to be included that you've programmed that you want included in the Java scanner. It might be things like utility routines. It might be fields of that sort, whatever you want in there. JLEX directives, and for example, here's things where if I wanted to return a class intlet token, I might include that up here so that it knows what an intlet token is. The directives, we'll use some of those, not necessarily all of those, allow you to give some customization information to the generated scanner. So, for example, here's a situation where I can have class fields or methods into the generated class. The other thing was a full generated code. End the file says, hey, when you hit end the file, here's what I'd like you to do. And for example, that would be the return that end the file token if we wanted that done. And it'll say, when you're returning tokens after calls, what's the class to be generated? I want my particular class to be used. So I say the type I want to use is a class name, presumably that's something I've generated. It's probably token this or token that. And when you see the startup, you'll see that we've already done some of that. As a utility, you can go ahead and give names to expressions which are otherwise unreadable, and these are called macros. You may want to use this. I use it from time to time, so I want to show you about that. So you can give a definition that represents something that's less readable. So here's an example. This is, I'm going to give a name to something that's readable to humans to something that's just an expression in JLEX that does a particular match. So one of those is digit. And it says, I want a digit to be any single character from 0 to 9. And instead of writing 0 to 9, because that may be less readable, I'll say, here's digit. And a way to activate that is put curly braces around it that says, I don't want this to be considered a regular definition name. I want it to be considered a macro call that replaces digit with the actual right-hand side. So we'll use that from time to time. Here's another example where I have any letter, and that represents anything in upper or lower case. So rather than writing A to Z, which is less readable, I say, give me any letter. But to make sure that it's not mistaking me to say match an A, match an N, match a Y, I put the braces around and say, read that as a macro name and replace it with its definition. So we'll use that from time to time. It's handy, and just so you're not surprised by it. Finally, we'll have, this is the main meat, and I'll have some examples of this, is on a line-by-line basis, you'll give the JLEX two things. One will be what we've been talking about most of tonight, namely a regular expression definition. Could be extremely simple. I'll have some of those. And following it in braces, because remember, braces is what Java uses for a block of code, is Java code that says when you go ahead and match this regular expression, and you, Mr. Scanner, figure out when this is the right regular expression. I'm not going to tell you. There may be lots of regular expressions. You figure out this time it's this one, that time it's that one. So that means, for example, I'd have a definition of a slash, for example, that says, hey, I'm a division operator. And later on, I'd have this, anything that's not an end of line, star, end of line. And those two definitions would be on separate lines in separate spots. And deciding whether this thing is to be matched as a single slash or that thing as double slash and extra is purely up to the scanner. I don't worry about it. It's job to do it right. And with very minor effort, I can make sure it'll do it right. So this is the big blessing of this, is namely, if I already had the slash implemented and working, and I want to put this new guy in, as long as I get him down correctly, there's no confusion about when to use one and when to use the other. I don't have to go back to slash and say, oh my gosh, how do I change slash so that it does not accidentally eat part of a single line comment? It can't because of the way this thing is implemented. And that's one of the beauties of this. Each line is independent. And it's almost like one of the goals of programming, and something we're very far away from, is to take a program and think of it almost as a deck of cards. And in the old days, as I'm sure you've heard, people actually programmed with punch cards. You used to be able to tell a computer nerd in those days because he or she would be walking around with a pile of books under their arms. That was before packs were common. And you'd have a deck of cards with rubber bands around it. And the rule is you always had at least two, maybe three, maybe four rubber bands on that deck of cards, because what was the worst thing that could happen is the rubber bands pop and the deck of cards falls on the floor. Because why? They were in order, and they're no longer in order. Just imagine if you had an editor, which occasionally, maybe it's a Stephen King type editor, where occasionally it just jumbles your lines, totally random. Line 10 is line 1 and so on, and says, there's your program. You'd be doomed. But it turns out that some programming languages, this is almost that form, you could almost do that and it wouldn't matter. With a couple of small gotchas, I could take each of those JLEX definition lines and shuffle them. And it really wouldn't matter very much. The only way it matters is if I have a tie, it's the situation where the earlier definition applies. So if I have a tie and two things match exactly, the earlier definition has to be placed earlier to take precedence, the later one not. And that's a fairly minor thing. You could actually get around that. But other than that, this is a really interesting approach. Namely, it's almost like, I always get in trouble at university, here maybe not so much so. I say, if you happen to be somebody who believes in the Ten Commandments, and I'm not going to preach in favor of them or not, the interesting thing about them is the numbering is irrelevant. You know, number 1 could be number 7, number 7 could be number 3, and all that would matter is if you went on a Sunday and a preacher would say, oh, you know, you're a sinner, you breached commandment 7. Now it was really commandment 3. But the notion is the numbering was relatively unimportant, the content what was important, and it's the same thing here. And ideally, programs ought to be like that, that the actual ordering is less important than the content, and to the extent we can do that, we improve programming. So we'll have a series of these lines, and let's see, do I have examples of them? Yeah, here are a couple of simple ones, and I think these are actually taken out of the startup package, and these actually should work. So we'll start with a real simple one, and then a couple of others that I'll explain. So remember, it's always in the form a pattern, and what happens is the pattern here is separated by a blank or a tab from the code. So in this case, I put a quote around the plus because remember, plus could be used as this iteration operator. So I say, if you see a single plus, I want you to do something. I want you to return to the caller a token. So what is it? Well, this is Java. So remember, when you create something new, you got to say new. So return me a new token. And the constructor takes a particular code that says, here are the various tokens I have. And there's actually a file that I give you that later on will be created by the scanner when we have a scanner that contains definitions of all the tokens the scanner cares about, which of course are all the tokens the scanner ought to generate. So in this case, go into the definition and find the token name plus, because this is the plus operator, and please go ahead and return a token customized to represent that token. And that's all that happens. So what happens is you might have a plus sign sitting as your next character, and you call the scanner from the parser, for example, and say, please give me another a token. It goes ahead and says, in this case, all I need to do is scan a single character, a plus, and the programmer told me when you see that, return, because it says return, and create a brand new token. Remember, this is Java, and you're creating objects all the time, and have the constructor say, of all the token possibilities, this one is going to be a token with the plus code in it. That's not so bad. Here's a simple example of white space. Now remember I said white space is scanned. Why? Because I have to get past it so I can get to the more interesting stuff that follows it. But I don't return it as a token. Because white space is there for readership. It blanks and tabs and new lines just so humans have the program look pretty. So it says here's a blank. I have a quoted string with a single blank in it in this case. And it's in this particular case, read one or more of them. So if I have a series of blanks, just read them all and get rid of them. And in this case, I do nothing at all. So when it executes this, this is like the null execution. It says, let's do nothing. And by doing nothing, I skip the particular white space. And what will happen is the scanner will resume scanning. It does not resume scanning up here automatically because I return to the caller. And the caller has to call the scanner again, say, oh, now I want another token, because in between I may do some processing. Here's one that's a little more complex, and I've gone ahead and broken it up onto several lines. So in this case, this brace on the digit represents that macro I showed you a couple of places back. So that's 0 to 9. So I say, if you see the 0 to 9, a single digit, and one or more of them match that, please. I'm not worrying about a sign yet. This is a simple one. And I said, I want you to return something. And I want you to return something that's fairly complex. So let's look at what we're doing here. In this case, I'm returning something that has some content. So it says, I'm a special kind of token. I'm not just an ordinary token. I'm an int token. That is a token that represents an integer. So I go into SIM and say, okay, my code is int lit, integer literal. But what is different than what I did previously is with a plus sign, I don't need any extra information. A plus sign is a plus sign is a plus sign. If you've seen one, you've seen them all. But that's certainly not true for integer literals. So I say, oh my gosh, you matched an integer. What did you match? Well, I've got a way of doing that. Namely, I simply call yytext. So yytext will go ahead and give me a string. But wait a minute, I got to return an integer. How do I convert an integer into a string? Now, at this stage, I'm not going to be worrying about errors or overflow. I'm going to say, going in this case, every basic type in Java has a wrapper class. And I mean like int, char, bool, etc. So for example, for int, it's capital integer. So this is a class that represents a single integer normally represented as int. The difference is this guy has all kinds of cool methods that allow me to manipulate an integer. So it says go ahead and take yytext and create an integer from it. It has a constructor that takes a string and makes an integer out of it. And I say, okay, class, now give me that integer value as an integer. So what I've done effectively in this line is convert a string 0, 1, 2, 3, whatever, into an actual numeric value and put it in integer form that Java can manipulate and make that a component of the integer literal token. So the intlit token says, I'm an integer literal, and moreover, I have an extra field that says, I'm an integer, and here's my numeric value. And that, of course, will be used later on in the scan. So, as I said, the regular expression is the cool part of this, and this is what I just said earlier, is that you tell it on a line-by-line basis what you want, but you don't tell it how to scan. We're going to understand. That's where this automata business comes, but that's because we're computer scientists. We could be computer users and simply say, okay, this is great. This guy's a genius. And in fact, that's sometimes if you go in software, they oftentimes have tools that help you build something, and they're called a genius this or a genius that. Maybe we should call this guy, instead of a generator, a genius. Genius sounds way cooler and way more lucrative. But effectively, that's all it is a way, with a little help from you, to build a quality scanner with a minimal amount of effort. So you say, what it is you want? I want this particular pattern matched, and when you see it, I want this particular token created. And you figure out when it's matched and execute the code to do the creation. So here's another example where I have a reserved word if. Now, in this case, I'm not doing the upper and lowercase business yet. It says matching a single if. And in this case, all you have to do, oops, I think this is the last slide here. Let me, cool. Boy, was that great timing. So this is actually my last slide. So let me just finish 30 seconds. So if you match the letters if, it gives you a token called if. And here's a case where I had to put plus around it, but essentially it simply says match a plus character and return the token plus. So it's a little more to it than what I've shown you, but this is the basic idea. So now you can read assignment 2, and I'm sure parts of it will still be unclear, but at least you'll get a general idea of what's going on. Download the Project 2 startup and give that a try. And next time we'll actually go through a little example of JLEX creating a scanner of sorts and actually go through the pieces and see how it operates. So have a good week, and I hope the snowplow guys have done their job. Otherwise, who has a four-wheel drive? I don't, so I may need to borrow a ride from somebody.